how do we protect our children who are over 18? And then the second part of this exam, given we're talking in this way, the second part of this discussion today will be on how to protect children who are under 18 and those that are overseas, because we have such a prominent emphasis on international clients. So, number one, once your child is 18, you no longer are in a position where you can make legal decisions on behalf of your child, unless you have a court order and you're appointed as guardian. It is a significant issue because today, children who are 18, while far more astute and sophisticated on world matters than 100 years ago, they also are really less independent than 100 years ago when they were married at 16 and took the family farm over at 18. So, the expression, the frontal lobe not fully developed until age 25 or more, hasn't changed biologically in that 100 years either. So how do we protect our children if they're in a car accident or if they have they're sick or they're hospitalized? The hospitals will not allow you to make those decisions. So you have to get your child to sign documents empowering you. And as we tell our clients and our clients' children, by the way, who are now our clients as well, you'll name the two people or the one person that you trust the most right now to make those decisions for you. And in time, as you develop and have a more complete permanent relationship with others, whether that's siblings or a significant other, life partner or spouse, they can jump in and take that primary role. And your parents can fade, if that's who you're choosing today, can fade into a second position. It must be done. There was a parade of people in our office here because as my daughter just headed off to Johns Hopkins for her first year of school, her classmates at Pingree and friends of ours in the community got their children to sign these documents with us to protect their children. It is not just the power of attorney, or some people think it's the healthcare document. It is not just that. It is the power of attorney as well. Why? Because maybe your child, you need to demand records from your child's school. Maybe you need to demand records from the public bus that your child was on when the accident occurred. Maybe you need to obtain police reports. All these things we hope that we never experience. But so it's the power of attorney in addition to the health care documents, which empower you to not just make decisions on your child's health care, but to push back if the hospital is saying that, God forbid, all hope is lost, that we very clearly say we want every extreme measure to be employed. You know, your children are of privilege, and that requires a responsibility as well to assure that we're getting them the best possible medical care. And maybe the local hospital in the inner city doesn't have that same agenda. So we are very, very focused on this as well. Imagine my daughter or others in Baltimore, and there's an accident. Well, there's a community hospital, which surely needs to get the gift of becoming a better hospital. And then there's Johns Hopkins, which is a world-ranked hospital. Well, what if she goes to the wrong one? How do we get her into the other hospital? So these priorities are critical, and we want to protect your children. So first order is to get that done. What are the necessities if my child travels overseas? So this is the reason and often the way that we come into contact with your clients, with our clients' children. Word comes out at the local university that your child is junior year, is studying overseas, and so there's the whole process of what that's all about and how it works, and that university tells you to sign healthcare documents and powers of attorney so that you can access your child overseas. And it is important they bring it up. By the way, they don't typically bring it up when your child is about to enter the college because they really don't want you meddling. They want your children to be independent, but that's fine. I don't necessarily want to meddle either, but I do know that when the time is to meddle, if I don't have the legal right to do that, I'm deprived. So the same issue happens when you're overseas. You know, different jurisdictions, different countries, and independent states have their own medical systems, and it's important. We don't know necessarily if there is a legal form there, but what we have found is that they will accept our American form. So for sure, you want to do that. There's no question. You also want to identify. If your child is traveling overseas, the local hospitals that they should be going to. When I was in Paris after law school, I hurt my shoulder and I went where the ambulance took me. That would not be what we want for your children, having the benefit of foresight with their parents getting involved. So it would be important to identify where your children are getting that care and making sure you have the medical documents in place. So now your child is 18. We haven't talked about a will. Should there be a will? Should your child have a will? And the answer is in the classic lines of a lawyer who's had a lot of experience and typically has some answers, it all depends. It all depends on whether your child has assets. And your children, you'd say, of course they have assets. You know, we've created trust for them, and we're leaving them in our wills. But we have already planned for your children not having legal assets. Often we'll have a new client come in and say, my child is getting married. I want to do a prenuptial agreement for them. And I'll say, to protect what assets? And they'll say, the assets that my child owns. And I'll say, well, if you are my client, if you are our firm's client, your child's assets would be in trust, so that they would be protected in the event of a marriage, and so there wouldn't be a need for the prenuptial as much. So I would tell you, though, your children, your assets that you're leaving your children, if they perish the thought were to pass away and meet with something untimely, there we are very clearly a layout what the succession should be for those assets. So we do not need to have a will for your children just because they are associated with you. However, if your child does have assets, if they've inherited money from other family members, if they have worked and built some net worth, you know, I was in my early 20s when I owned my purchased my first home. So those things needed to be dispensed with under a will. So if your child has unprotected assets, we would say yes for sure. When they're in their mid-20s, we think at that point it's appropriate, even if there isn't significant assets, to identify you both or your parents or loved ones or siblings as representatives, because you want to have the function of having fiduciaries named, executors and trustees and so forth. But immediately after they turn 18, it has not been a big priority for us to do that. We certainly don't want to do more work that is superfluous or not needed when there is such a high priority on focusing on work that is needed right now. So that's where we stand on number three on your list. Number four, should I appoint my child as my representative in my incapacity planning? So for sure, once they're 18, they can be named. People have varying views on this. It all depends on your child's level of maturity. You know, things to keep in mind are, you know, if I'm incapacitated, do I want my 18-year-old child who is away at college having to be involved in that kind of monumental decision? Maybe they're the right person. And frankly, we have many clients who say they're the only person. We, in some respects, have no choice. In other instances, we'll say, I choose this person, but my children should be consulted, even my children who are not 18 yet. So that's the second choice. Number three is to say, listen, I want my child on here now, and I don't want you bugging me, McManus and team, every year to get my child on, so put them on now, and then we'll have them officially legally qualify at age 25. This way it's done, it's dusted, it's up on the shelf, and we'll address it going forward. Number five, should I make outright gifts to my adult children? What are the risks that these, of these gifts and custodial accounts? First of all, we are not fans of making gifts to children in any excess amounts for two reasons. One, when you're over $14,000, you pay gift tax, or we have to file a gift tax return, and we have to reduce those gifts from your exemption of gift taxes on the $5 million federal exemptions, $5 million plus. So we don't necessarily recommend that. Number two is we don't recommend gifts in excess of $14,000 because those should go to your child in trust to protect them. The last thing we need to hear is my daughter Allie is going from Hopkins to Georgetown or to Duke on a on a fun weekend, and there's an accident, and she's the one driving, and all the family say, you know, we love your daughter, but we have to clean out her account because of this accident. We get that, and that's what insurance is there for. We never want to deprive victims of what they have. But what we do want to avoid is having her or others be vulnerable at this point to actions being brought by lawyers with ill intentions or nefarious means. So our approach here is protect the assets and leave them to your children into trust. Of course, many of you have done much more significant planning, and we have trusts that have been created that have 7- and 8-figure amounts in them, which are not for your child to use the spending money, but just to get them over the wall and outside of the compound, away from the jurisdiction of taxes. But smaller gifts, for sure, we just need to know that those are always vulnerable. Next, my child is getting married. Should I review with them whether a prenuptial is appropriate? So we were on with an individual yesterday who was signing a prenuptial. There are values to a prenuptial agreement. We are having that discussion. I think that it's important to get them on board with respect to the notion that you come to the marriage with certain assets, you inherit assets from your family, and that those assets should be separate from the assets in a marital estate. So my wife and I, Rosemary, met and we had two nickels to rub together. I can remember when we started the firm trying to get $2 to rub together to get on the PATH train back to New Jersey. So everything that we have built is between the two of us. And so, God forbid, we would suffer the unthinkable of a marital strife. They would be divided in that way. But if your child comes to the marriage with assets that they've built, if they're inside a trust, they're protected. But if they have assets outside the trust, they still are protected unless your child decides to buy a home, which would be a typical one, with these assets and put them in joint name. Then you're in a situation where your child is now a joint owner with their spouse, and in a divorce, each would get half. What we would recommend then is that loans be made to the marital relationship, and that if there's a divorce, that the loan be paid off first, and then the house be sold, and whatever is remaining be divided. So if they were buying a $1 million house, and that's a high number for any starter, but if they were buying a $500,000 house, still very high, and they took $100,000 of their own money, which would be 20% of the down payment, that would be a loan to the couple from the child's trust, or from the your child individually, or from the two of you, or from a parent or a sibling, and then that would always come first. The prenuptial, however, addresses what assets are built during the course of the marriage. You always hear that people in Hollywood sign these giant cause celeb prenuptials, and you say, well, McManus, I just looked online, and so-and-so is worth $50 million. Why are they signing a prenuptial? If they're coming to the marriage, they know well enough not to integrate them into the marriage. That's true. However, the asset that they build during the marriage, because they're highly compensated, is at risk. So your child signing a prenuptial would have something to do with the idea that if they and the assets they're gaining from the trust that you have and their well-educated background are generating a significant amount of income during the course of the marriage, then there may be a notion that we want to say those assets should be subject to a prenuptial agreement because they were earned during the course of the marriage, but yet they came from your child's education and trust monies and so forth. So we would recommend a prenuptial agreement to be signed. The problem with signing prenuptial agreements is that if your child's spouse is with a well-versed divorce lawyer, they will demand all of your child's assets. I would recommend that you push back and that you say only the assets that my child has in his name alone. I would have your child state that. You guys can't be involved, of course, and not the assets that are inside a trust because those are not relevant to the marital estate anyway. But I think it's important to at least address that. So, yes, on the prenuptial agreement, but limit the pieces you're doing. Number seven. Now let's talk about children below 18 years of age. My wife and I have the privilege of having both. So if my wife and I are headed to Florida for a weekend and are on that trip, we leave our 11 and 16-year-old with a family member or with my 18-year-old child, what happens if my son needs to get raised to the hospital? Or, you know, other examples are husband and wife work and there's a nanny with your child at home, or your children are out visiting, my children visiting their cousins in South Jersey and there's an accident. What are we doing to have them handle decisions if you're not there? The hospitals will not admit your child into the hospital without mom and dad being there or without one of them being there. They make the exception, of course, if there is a life and death situation. Their duty is to save the lives of others, so we want to make sure that they want to make sure that they are not their protocol is not overriding their most basic responsibility to save lives of others. So they'll admit your child. But if your child has stomach pains or a bad headache where we can't be clear that it is something serious, it could be spinal meningitis, it could be an appendicitis, who knows, they will not admit your child until they know that of the gravity of the medical matter, and that may mean your child waits in the waiting room for 12, 24 hours, 36 hours, they're sent home. I can tell you three times, or at least two out of our three pregnancies, my wife was sent home because it was too early. Then we wound up racing back. So none of those are situations. You want to name a third party to act on your behalf. We will name our 18-year-old daughter in this respect. We will have other family members. People say, should I name our help and our home that have been with us for many years. And you know, many of you know that help becomes part of the family. It's not unusual for us to see that help is included in your will for some amount because they become so relevant. But in other instances, they may leave because, you know, they are driven by the economics of the relationship and it may force them to. So we never recommend having the help. What we do is we tell the help, here is the document and here is a list of six or seven people that should serve, that can serve. We notify all those people and we keep one original taped to the inside of one of the kitchen cabinets, easily accessible, in an envelope, sealed, to only be taken out. And the help can then take your child to the hospital, and then your child will meet the representative in the family, who can also work via telephone. So these are important pieces that I want to emphasize that are critical for minor children. What if both parents become incapacitated permanently? So many years ago, we were working with a senior executive at one of the top companies in the city, a very creative guy, and he said, you know, you've spent so much time building out the structure for my minor children in the event that I and my wife pass away, who the guardians are, who the advisory group is, education for our children, quality of life, travel, who has the right to visit, medical priorities. And we do that because our children are our most important piece in our lives. So he said, well, what happens if my wife and I become incapacitated? The person you've chosen is the guy who is makes all of our business decisions. What the heck does he know, and what power does he have to raise our children? So our documents for powers of attorney are far more comprehensive than something you can print off on the Internet. Not that anybody who is associated with us would do that. And they focus on the idea that if mom and dad are incapacitated, that the language included in the wills with respect to all of the quality of life is now included, so that the power of your agents can then bring in your guardians, can bring in your advisory group, can assure that your family members have visitation with your children, can move forward on legal documents for your children as well. So this is important to be clear that we want to protect your children's quality of life as well. Next, what happens? What are the issues for minor children in foreign jurisdictions or children with foreign citizenship? So, you know, the World Trade Center taught us a very important lesson about the fragility of life, and for those of you involved in it, there's no question that today's world is as dangerous as ever, and we must be focused on protecting ourselves and our family and be mindful that these things are destined to happen again. I pray, like so many others, that it never happens again, but we must be focused on it. And the issue is, if you pass away and you have children who are of a foreign extraction, if they are were born in the U.S., but your guardians and your relationships are overseas, and you expect your children to go over, well, important in this priority here is that we want to make sure that your children have their passports. If they're going to live in the U.S., you want to make sure that they can visit their family overseas, and you want to keep your children's passports current today. You also want to keep their foreign passports current so that they can travel. The purpose of this number 9 is to focus on children traveling, and we've had exactly the set of facts where the aunt wanted to take a child overseas and needed to get a court order in order to have him leave the country. Why? Because of human trafficking, all the risks that you have with children. And we agreed. It was a lot of work, but we would have had it easier if our child, if the child had had a foreign, had a U.S. passport. And we needed not to do that work. So it's important also be focused on if the child is going overseas to visit family, you know, there are abilities to travel as a unaccompanied minor, but you have to have all of your paperwork in place. If your child, if the child of a foreign nationality moves abroad to live with a guardian, having the U.S. passport current once they're over there is important, and that's a directive that we can help out with if the guardians are in place. And you want to make sure that there's no visa requirement. We just flew into Argentina, and before you go, you have to pay a fee, and you have to have that evidence, and it can't be on your iPhone or your other technology. It has to be printed out. And I promise you, they mean that. We saw the evidence of it being at the gate and then leaving one country and going to another. So paperwork is important, and we can happily talk you through that. Your child is under 18, and your guardians are overseas. Okay, so we've spoken about this a little bit. It is important to name local guardians, because how quickly can your guardians come over? Are your guardians have the finances to do it? Do your guardians require a visa? Is there any issue? We've had some clients that have said, I've got a parking ticket in the U.S. and I'm afraid they're going to arrest me when I arrive at the gate the next time I come in. You know, what are the hesitations? Well, we don't have time for that if mom and dad have passed away. We need to get that child protected. So we don't want them to go in with social services and be put in a group home. So we name local guardians in your wills today to protect them. If your child is to then go back overseas, we need to apply for the visa if necessary in that country. There will be health screenings, background checks. These are consuming tasks. So the guardian named in the will cannot make it to the U.S. to take custody. A temporary local guardian, all the more important, needs to be put in place here. Some states, like New York, will not appoint a non-U.S. citizen guardian, will require a local guardian who can assist in this. So we have already set that as a protocol because we want somebody immediately in there. New Jersey, Connecticut, and Florida, places, of course, that we have the most prominent amount of our practice, also are not in a position, do not require that kind of background work with an alternate. So we think that New York is on track with this, but we want that temporary guardian in place right away. Children in the U.S. with a green card are only permitted to leave the country for a period of 1 year before needing to reapply. So if your child, if you're a non-citizen and you're a green card holder and your children are green card holders and you guys pass away, your child goes back, we want to protect their access in and out of the U.S. Imagine if they were 14 or 15 getting ready to go to college in the U.S., went overseas for a year because you passed away, and then couldn't get back into the country because a year had passed and their green card had expired. So for sure, we'll be advising your guardians, but you want to keep that in mind as well, that your guardians know if you're going overseas to protect your child's access in and out of the U.S. New Jersey will send the paperwork for guardianship to the embassy or the consulate of the country where your child is, where the guardian resides. The testamentary guardian will have to sign the papers at the embassy, and the sole guardianship can be granted. So New Jersey, different than New York. I don't think it's a bad idea the way they're approaching it, because in effect we do want the country that your child is going to not have to whip out a New York form guardianship appointment, and we would recommend that it be done overseas anyway. So we like what New Jersey is saying. We don't think it's that they're addressing the fact that we need to have a minor guard, we need to have a U.S. guardian during this period of time. We also like New York because they appoint a temporary guardian, but we don't like it that they're not focusing on having your guardians get appointed in their foreign country. So in either respect, I think that it's important that we address these pieces for your minor children. And I think what's important here is those of you who have adult children to start to think about what you can do to protect your children's children. And particularly, you know, this is very relevant because you have spent all these years raising your children, educating them well. When we were in South America, my daughter said that I want to live here. Of course, that broke my wife's and my heart. But if she is thinking of living and marrying overseas, what are we doing to give her good advice to protect her during that period, which we pray is temporary, and protecting her children.